Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and I'm delighted today to be joined by David Slattery Christie. David's a writer, an advisor on the Robert Altman film Gosford Park, which if you haven't seen it, what are you even doing listening to this? It's one of the one of the best, I say, Hollywood films made about Britain that I think is, you know, in the last sort of 20 or 30 or 40 years even. And today we have got a fascinating conversation about the kind of the, not so much the rise and fall, just the fall of a British aristocrat, Harry Clifton. And it kind of mirrors, really, it's a story that sort of mirrors many of the fortunes of the British aristocracy in the 20th century. But anyway, to begin, firstly, David, welcome, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here and to meet you.
Lovely. So, firstly, let's start by just talking a bit about who Harry Clifton was, and also there's a part of Evelyn Waugh is kind of involved in the story, isn't it?
He kind of comes into the story a bit later in the 20s. But Harry Clifton was, to give him his correct name, it was Henry Talbot de Vere Clifton, but he was known as Harry to everybody. And he was the firstborn son to John Talbot Clifton and Violet Clifton, who were the... he was the squire of the Clifton dynasty at the time. Harry was born in 1907. So he was born into a family that for hundreds of years were one of the largest landowners in the UK. Mm. So they were quite a significant family, really. And Harry's mother was directly descended to Charles II as well. So yeah, there was a bit of royal blood in there too. But Harry's father was a very typical sort of tough Victorian adventurer. And interestingly, considering the kind of errant way that Harry went from being a young man, his father had actually been quite a gambler, a drinker when he was a young man, and caused a bit of concern. But he even had an affair with Lily Langtry, who was the famous sort of, who'd become infamous because she'd been the mistress of the Prince of Wales, who became Edward VII. But Harry's father was also friends with the Tsar and his family. Mm. And the Grand Duke Michael actually visited Lytham Hall, which is the family seat in Lancashire, in 1908. So they had quite grand connections, the family, really, in lots of ways. But I think Harry was brought up because he was the first son. His father was quite hard on him, really.
Right.
Because where Harry wanted to be more sort of bookish and academic and had aspirations to be a poet and a writer, his father kind of was quite strict and not very nice with him because he felt that he needed to focus on more practical things because he was going to take over the estates and the management of all the land. And they had estates in Ireland, which they had to give up after the First World War. But his father bought another big estate on Islay up in Scotland as well. So, you know, his father's attitude was, you're responsible for all these estates and all the people who work on them. So you need to get your head out of the clouds and man up a bit, really. And unfortunately, Harry didn't react well to that and went the other way in many ways.
I was reading a thing recently. It was in the biography of the autobiography of Felix Dennis, who is the kind of the hippie publisher, millionaire, sort of maniac, really. And he made some points about inherited wealth, and he said, well, you know, the kind of the somebody like the Duke of Westminster, their job, if you can describe it as that, is to safeguard the dynastic wealth against one profligate generation that will inevitably prop up. And you know, it's interesting when you think about, I mean, if you think about kind of social class and sort of how that's kind of economically formed in various ways. In this case, you know, Harry Clifton was being told, look, listen, whatever you think your future is, your job, your duty is to safeguard the family's wealth, because, you know, that can go, that can be swept away.
It's kind of all about the next generation, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
For these people, it's kind of their life is almost irrelevant. That their job is to preserve everything for the next generation to come, which is kind of quite a heavy burden, I would imagine.
Well, it is, and it's if you look at sort of, you know, the fragmentation of social class in the 20th century, you have people that were born the sons of miners who say, "Well, I'm not going down the pit. I want to." Go and do something else. And those people have become working class intellectuals and want to be a writer, or a poet, or a painter. And I suppose when you look at the story of Harry Clifton, as we will, there seems to be this kind of rebellion almost against the burdens placed on him.
Sure, yeah. It's interesting because having gone through sort of like two or three years now of looking into this man's life, and it's interesting when one of the first times I ever visited Lytham Hall, because now Lytham Hall's open to the public for the first time ever, literally in the last few years, a lot of the Clifton history is now coming to life again. And I remember going, and one of the guides at the hall sort of said, and of course that awful Harry Clifton, and immediately my ears pricked up, because I thought, that's quite a kind of sweeping generalization. Why was this man considered so awful? So, of course, that fascinated me, because I'm kind of drawn to people who are a bit forgotten, and maybe people who are a bit black sheep or not quite, didn't fit into the norm of what was expected of them. So that fascinated me. And the more I looked into his life, and the more I thought, there must be more to this man than just being that awful Harry Clifton. There must be more to this. So that's kind of what made me start sort of digging deeper, really.
Yeah.
To discover, you know, why he did what he did. Because there is a part of me now at this end of my journey that I do wonder whether there was a part of Harry that made the decision to do what he did and be so destructive, because he never wanted anyone to go through what he had to go through and the expectations that were kind of heaped upon him, really, that he rebelled against.
I mean, I notice, I mean, in my day job is in essentially mental health, and there are all sorts of ways that people kind of respond when they're seemingly given no choice. And one of them is what they call in transactional analysis, I'll show you. And it's kind of that, you've told me I have no choice. Well, let's just see about that. And I wonder if there's an element of that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, there was some interesting letters, a couple of letters that, and I've included some extracts in the book, that Harry Clifton wrote to the estate manager. And the estate manager, William, who, he seemed to have a more mentor-type relationship with Harry than his own father did. And Harry wrote to William before his father had died, and because he did have a younger brother, Michael, Harry, and kind of in this letter said, look, I don't think I'm cut out for this. I don't think it's right that, can you do something to, I've tried to speak to my father and say, I don't want to inherit, let it go to Michael, he's more suited. And of course, his father dismissed him, but in this letter to William, the estate manager, Harry is saying, can you not speak to my father and try and make this happen? He said it's to do with, it would make death duties worse, but there must be a way around this. Michael would be better at it than me.
Yeah.
But of course, they never did, and it was he was refused. And maybe had that happened, maybe things would have turned out differently. But interesting you talk about the mental health side, because there was a point in the 1930s where Harry's mother had, on a couple of occasions, tried to get him certified as insane because of, you know, the way he was squandering money, the way he was selling everything off to and doing sort of very strange, eccentric things. And in a way, Harry was the aristocratic eccentric's eccentric.
Yeah.
he was even eccentric in their terms, do you know what I mean? So, but yeah, so it's, you know, and Harry was, he also had like mentors and guides. He was interested in spiritualism. And for instance, every week he had a permanent suite at the Ritz after he inherited. And he had an advisor called the White Goddess. And once a week in the restaurant at the Ritz, Harry would dine with her and spend the whole evening talking to her and chatting to her. And of course, the staff at the Ritz in the restaurant, they served her and spoke to her and pulled the chair out for her to sit down. But actually, nobody could see her but Harry.
Yes. So he's, you know, this is either kind of eccentricity or perhaps sort of, kind of psychosis or something. But
yeah. But so, maybe it was somebody who would listen to him.
Yeah.
Where in his own family, nobody would, you know. And I think there's something very poignant and quite sad about that, I feel. Yeah.
Well, there is. And, you know, if you look in the various kind of annals of kind of what you call abnormal psychology or kind of there is countless examples of people of creating those sorts of imaginary circumstances for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so essentially the family fortune under Harry is squandered. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned spiritualism. He was part of what you would call a cult, is that right?
Well, yes, he eventually he kind of when he went to America, he met another sort of woman who was known as the Ghost of Hollywood, and he gave her thousands and thousands of pounds to build a temple. And I think it was the Agabeg occult temple. It was about £40,000 he gave her. But she turned out, interestingly, to be a con woman.
Yeah.
Because she was involved with Lou Bryce, who was the famous comedian Fanny Bryce's brother, and they nearly stung him out of another £40,000 over a poker game, but it turned out to be an illegal form of poker. So, but he seemed to do this. He seemed to do all this with a very blasé attitude. There was, I think it was Brian Desmond Hurst who Harry invested money in to make a Edgar Allan Poe film, The Beating Heart, from that particular story. When he was sort of having lunch with Harry at the Ritz one day, he saw Harry talking to this young guy, and afterwards he said, "You do realise, you know, how do you know him?" And he said, "Well, you know, I've invested in a couple of projects." He said, "Well, you do know he's a con man, don't you, and a fraud?" And Harry said, "Oh, yes, of course, darling, but everybody deserves a second chance." So it's like he almost did it knowingly.
Yeah.
And you know, that's, you know, who knows? None of us knows what was going on in his mind, but it certainly wasn't normal, rational behaviour, was it?
Really? No. And I think I noticed in part of the story, we mentioned that the novelist, he probably wasn't quite a novelist at the time when he knew him, but the future novelist Evelyn Waugh had been friends with Harry Clifton, hadn't he?
Well, it seems that when, because Harry had gone to Downside School in Somerset, which was very sporty, and it was run by Benedictine monks, and he was quite miserable there because he hated sport. But again, it was his father's way of trying to sort of make him a man, if that's, yeah, you know. When he left there, his father got him a place at Oxford, and Harry went along with it. When I did a bit of research, because nobody knew where he'd gone, which college he'd gone to in Oxford. So I did a bit of research with a friend who's a research fellow in Oxford. So they did a bit of digging for me and discovered that he matriculated at Christchurch and had rooms at Christchurch. Now, this was in the sort of like mid-1920s, and Evelyn Waugh had been at Oxford just earlier than Harry, because he'd set up with one or two friends and Alistair Graham as well, the Notorious Hypocrites Club, which was basically a club, a private drinking club where homosexual men could go, lesbians could go, transvestites could go. Anybody who was sort of interested in sexual fluidity, there was orgies apparently. It was quite notorious. In fact, it was so bad in the end that the university had it closed down by 1929. Now, Evelyn Waugh had a feud with his tutor who wouldn't let him graduate. So he kind of haunted Oxford a bit longer in the hope that his tutor would relent. And they said that he hadn't done enough weeks in 1 year to graduate. So he kind of hung about in the hope they would allow him to do that, but they never did, obviously. And in 1928, Harry's father died suddenly. So Harry inherited in 1928. So the other thing they have in common is they were both sent down from Oxford without degrees.
Right.
Which is a bit of a tragedy in itself, really, you know. But Evelyn Waugh always said that, you know, they'll remember me long after they've forgotten any of my tutors. And I suppose that turned out to be right, really.
Yeah.
Now, for me, it's kind of inconceivable to imagine that somebody like Harry at Oxford, because he loved being at Oxford and he loved all this kind of hedonism, that it seems fairly sure that they met at Oxford. That's where they first met or encountered each other. And Harry, being like he is, was kind of, you know, he was news, really, and he was, you know, a lot of the sort of titled families knew about him and knew about his eccentricities. So that was really where things developed. Now, when I discovered that Harry had rooms at Christchurch, of course, this is where we first meet Sebastian Flight.
Yes.
In Brideshead, who's also very eccentric and has very odd sort of ideas about life, etc. And then Evelyn Waugh visited Lytham Hall in the 30s. And at one occasion, he wrote to Lady Asquith to tell her that all the Cliftons were tearing mad because obviously he met Harry's mother and his sister Daffodil during, you know, these visits in the 30s. So, and it was very interesting to then discover that apparently Violet Clifton, Harry's mother, in 1945, when Brideshead was published, was absolutely furious with Evelyn Waugh and never spoke to him again because she was convinced that he'd based Sebastian Flight on Harry.
Yes.
And she also recognised bits of herself in Lady Marchmaine as well.
So, and Lytham Hall was Brideshead, I presume.
Well, I mean, he went there, but I mean, in the end, he used Castle Howard, didn't he, which was in Yorkshire. But then Castle Howard's much... I mean, don't get me wrong, Lytham Hall is a beautiful Georgian house, and it is very grand in its own way. But I can see why he went with Castle Howard, because it sort of has something extra, really.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt Evelyn Waugh visited Lytham Hall. He knew the Cliftons. He had an opinion about them. So the more you look at Harry and his eccentricities, you can kind of start to understand why his mother would think what she thought. So, it all more intriguing for me, really. Yeah.
I think it's because you obviously been an advisor regarding Ivan Novello on Gosford Park.
And of course, Ivan Novello was the only factual character in Gosford Park.
Yes. And I think that it was a really interesting choice to put that character in the film. And I think it was saying something about where the aristocracy was after the First World War. Mm. And you have this relatively new thing of, you know, basically a working class person who becomes.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Famous and wealthy based on talent and the sort of the new media of the time, and I guess if you
and slightly looked down upon as well, you know.
Well, yes,
by the, you know, of course, we'll, oh yes, you write music and you act in plays, but of course we'll never see them because we'll never go to that, you know. It's, and with Evelyn Waugh it was the same. It was, you know, a lot of the aristocracy at the time, that their attitude was that he wrote cheap novels, and of course I'll never read them, darling, because I don't read things like that. So it's but Robert Altman, interestingly, had always been a great fan of Novello and his music, and had always wanted to use him in a film, and you know, he wanted the character of Novello to be brought alive, because it gave you, also in the film, it gave you that alternate dynamic between the nouveau riche and the, you know, established aristocracy. And it kind of highlighted the snobbery, really.
Yeah.
Between the two, yeah.
And for anybody that lives in my hometown here, Cardiff, if you want to know where, or go and see where Ivan Novello grew up, you can walk down through Canton, and I think there's a blue plaque on the wall there. And the place where you're walking really is the beginnings of the beginnings of the Victorian kind of docklands.
Yeah.
So he was, Ira Davis was proper Cardiff working class. There is a pub in Canton called the Ira Davis in his honour. That gives you a sense of.
There's a statue there as well. Is it outside the New Millennium Theatre? Yeah,
I think so. Yes.
Yeah, there's a statue as well. Yeah.
The I think with the story of Harry Clifton, obviously, you know, he went out to Hollywood and backed some poorly thought through film project. But there you've got this kind of interaction between this old money, which you know, born of land ownership more than anything else, and has been in the family since probably the Middle Ages, that feels very shaky and vulnerable in the 20th century, having these interactions with these sorts of new forms of generating wealth and, you know, mass entertainment and that kind of thing. And you're in an
age. I think also for Harry Clifton, like as for Evelyn Waugh, I think the generation that were young after the First World War, they kind of made the decision they didn't want to continue what had always been.
Yeah.
They wanted to make the world in their own image.
Yeah.
They didn't want to have to conform to those kind of Victorian Edwardian ideals anymore, and they kind of, you know, they rebelled against the system and against the establishment. And you know, a lot of these aristocratic families, that they saw talking about money as a bit sort of a bit coarse, a bit common, really. You didn't talk about things like that. But people that came along in the 20s, like Ivan Novello and Noel Coward, and these people who became sort of very, very wealthy, influential people, they were seen as vulgar.
Yeah.
But they were the new way. And you know, people like Harry, he was attracted because he thought the film medium was fascinating. Unfortunately, he lost a lot of money because he didn't make very good decisions. And, you know, going back to the mental health thing, he very much sort of deluded himself that he was this marvelous, wonderful businessman, and all these people who flocked to get him to invest in their dodgy schemes were coming to him because they thought he was this marvelous business guru that he just wasn't. Yeah. And maybe for him, by doing it, he enjoyed making other people happy by investing in their project and making their dreams come true, where his dreams had been crushed, really, by his family and the expectation that's put upon him.
He strikes me
there's a lot of interest in psychology with him, really. And I mean, even his marriage, really, which was very short and very strange. And it's said that actually Lillian was an American socialite, and they went on sort of like drinking benders. And one day when they woke up and sobered up, they realized they were married. And it was a very volatile marriage. And of course, Harry did the Harry thing and ended up buying two Imperial Fabergé eggs on a whim at auction to sort of please this new wife he had. But I'm sure those Fabergé eggs appealed to him because of his father's friendship with the Russian imperial family, which had been wiped out, you know. So, you know, there's always a link and a connection in what he did as to where his family had been at one point.
He strikes me as having been a terrifically lonely person.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because once his marriage had collapsed after a couple of years, he married in 1937, they were divorced by 1941, and the rosebud egg, actually, was sold at auction in New York in 1941 or two. So I'm kind of guessing that that was part of the divorce settlement, that, you know, she got that and it was sold. But interestingly, it's the only one of the Fabergé eggs that has been damaged. And they think it was damaged when it was owned by somebody around the period where Harry owned it with Lillian. So whether it got hurled across the room or not, I don't know. But there you go. That's just an aside. But but after the First World War, but by the end of the 1930s, a lot of the land the family owned, he'd sold off to liquidate it to get the money.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of the Second World War, he kind of drifted more and more into fantasy.
Yeah.
And he always classed himself as a bachelor mm-hmm. of royal blood. Now, that bit was true, we know, through his mother's line. But his delusion seemed to... he seemed to disappear further into them once the Second World War was over. Yeah. And they never spoke... Evelyn Waugh and the Cliftons never spoke again. After Brideshead was published. Yeah.
And finally, in the end, you know, it's a very sad ending to the story, really, isn't there? He sort of dies in 1979, penniless.
Interesting. He outlived all his siblings. His younger brother, everybody. He outlived everybody. Evelyn Waugh, everybody. But by 1979, he wasn't exactly penniless, to be fair. I think he had less than £30,000.
Right.
And Lytham Hall had been repossessed with a deal because he had mortgages with Guardian Royal Exchange, the insurance company. Now, they in a deal, they basically repossessed it, but they used it as their headquarters, which is why it was never open to the public until a few years ago. But anyway, he ended up living in Brighton in this kind of seedy Emeris hotel, which was owned by a soothsayer. Now, there's probably a good chance that she got the money to buy that from Harry, I would say. He had less than £30,000 left when he died, and in his lifetime, he went through the equivalent today of about £70 million.
Right.
That was just squandered and blown away. Yeah.
Right.
And it was very sad. A sad ending. He was alone, he had a heart attack, and I've now that I know what I know about him, I couldn't imagine why anybody would call him the awful Harry Clifton.
No.
I think in a way he was quite brave, because he did what he wanted to do. He wanted to be just himself, and he did that. He managed to sort of blow and squander and destroy his family's heritage, but, you know, he kind of continued on his own path until the very end.
Yeah. He I was just kind of imagining the Sid Vicious cover version of the song My Way there for a moment. The kind of
No.
So let's just talk about the book for a moment. Okay, so tell us about the book and where people can purchase it. Is it currently available, or are we waiting?
It is, yeah. It was released officially on the 16th of November, so it's available now. It's available any bookstores, really. You can, you know, you can get Flight or Fancy, Evelyn Waugh meets Harry Clifton on the Road to Brideshead. You can get it through Amazon, all good bookstores. I would recommend people go to their local bookstore.
Yeah.
If you possibly can, please, because
this is our message.
We must support local bookstores.
I was about to say, this is the message at the end of every podcast, support your local, but thank you so much for bringing that in. Yes, please, please look after your local bookstore, because you'll miss it when it's gone.
Yeah. At the end of the day, for a piece of history, it's a great story to just read. Even if you've never heard of them, it's a great story, and you can enjoy it for that. You know, if you want to know more about the Cliftons, you can find out beyond that book. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, it's a stepping stone into a very, very fascinating period in our history.
Yes.
And it's great. And bringing those people to life has been an absolute joy, really, because they don't make them like that anymore. No. That's for sure. Yeah.
No, it's a snap. Obviously, it's a snapshot of a world that, you know, less than a century ago was with us. I mean, we still have aristocrats, but not in the way that, you know, say in the 1920s.
Well, they don't have the same power, do they?
Now,
No. You've got the odd one or two still, like the Duke of Westminster and the Duke of Devonshire, but a lot of the small and minor aristocratic families have, well, they've become tourist attractions, really.
Yes.
They've kind of had to become a tourist attraction, haven't they, to survive and keep going.
Yes. Swamped by the modern world. Well, there we must finish. David, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and I do
and
hope that we can talk about dissolute aristocrats again sometime.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
I have actually. There's a few months ago, I did publish a book because we've been talking about Ivan Novello and Gosford Park. Ivan Novello did a biography of him, an autobiography up to 1933. That's as far as he went. They'd never been published before, but I did include an unabridged version in a new version of the hardback of Ivan Novello, My Life and In Search of Ruritania. So if anybody's interested in that, that's available as well.
I'll put links in the show notes, so anyone that wants to look at find those, then they can do.
And it talks about Gosford Park and what went on as well in the Novello biography I did.
Fantastic. So, please, if you're listening and you want to watch a good movie this afternoon, watch that movie. You'll love it.
Gosford Park. Brilliant.
Thanks so much, David. All the best.
And you too. Thank